For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Practice commitment period, and Nyozan Erek Shut is the Chuso or head monk for that, and so he's giving. Paula, could you help me?
Sorry about that.
That's okay. You may want to tilt it.
Yeah.
At an angle. Anyway, Nyozan will be giving his first talk as Chuso or head monk this morning. So, thank you, Nyozan.
So, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Today's Easter. I'm sure many of you know that, and some of you may be doing things later in the day. But Easter, you know, for our Christian friends and family, you know, is a day, it commemorates a day when the sinful, fallen nature of the world, of humankind, is redeemed, or at least potentially redeemed. You know, there's a further thing that has to happen beyond Christ's resurrection in the thinking, the way the thinking goes, and that's that a person makes the effort to accept that. It's kind of an interesting thing, that it falls out this way, because there's an idea in Buddhism, a very important idea, called bodhicitta, which is what Taigen has asked me to talk about today, that it has a certain similarity to this. And I'll talk about the idea of, I'll break down the idea of bodhicitta a little bit later. But the overall notion is that at some point in people's practice, in people's lives, they get the sense, there something arises, and they come to understand that the world of suffering, the world of dukkha, the fallen world, if you will, the world in which our experience and our relationships are corrupted or interfered with by what we call the three poisons of greed, hate, and delusion, they get the sense that that's not the total picture, that there's something else, something possible. And they can start to explore that possibility. And then they realize, yeah, things could be different, but this is going to require something of me, too. It's going to require that I engage actively in the pursuit of this possibility, this reality. That sense, that action, are what in Buddhism we refer to as bodhicitta. Bodhicitta sometimes is referred to as the thought of enlightenment or the aspiration for enlightenment. And I feel a little uncomfortable with both of those ways of putting it, and I'll try to explain why. The first part, bodhi, of course, people will recognize the term. It's in It means fundamentally awakening. It turns up in a lot of compounds. But then there's this other term, citta. Now, citta refers to, in Sanskrit, it's one of the many words that applies to a kind of mentality. There are other words when they break it down, manas, for example, or vijnana, consciousness, or manas, the idea of the mind as a perceptual sense organ kind of thing. But citta is broader, and I don't mean to get super technical here, but I know that many of you know that there, in Buddhism there are these what we call the skandhas, the five skandhas. For those of you who are not familiar with the idea, these are the sort of constituent kind of categories, heaps into which Buddha's thinking breaks down human experience. And they're thought to be comprehensive. In other words, we can understand our experience in our lives in terms of these things without remainder. So those things are rupa or form. And then the other is just, you know, they're different translations or whatever, but form, feeling, thought, perception, form, feeling, perception, impulse, or consciousness. And in this sort of schema, citta refers to everything except for form, rupa, physicality. And I think this is really interesting. The Japanese word for bodhicitta is bodaishin. The bodai is, you know, simply a derives from a Chinese transliteration of bodhi, and then the sheen, they use this compound or this character sheen to translate citta. The sheen, as many of you know, can refer to both sort of mind and to heart. And I think that's a really interesting choice. You know, I mean, I find it very interesting that that's the word that was used, because in talking about bodhicitta, you know, you get these translations like the thought of enlightenment or the aspiration towards enlightenment, even the idea of enlightenment. And I think those are all, you know, aspiration, that's maybe works, but the, you know, thought, idea, I think those are really misleading, because it gives you the sense that, you know, into a practitioner's life there comes some kind of a mental idea, and this could happen actually, you know, that something's going to happen or that they're moving in a certain direction, and then, you know, that's what they aim for, that. This becomes a goal. Whereas I think it's actually much, in this case, it's maybe something like, rather than say thought of enlightenment, really something like awakening heart is a closer to the intent, because it's not you know that there's some state enlightenment that we're trying to hitch our wagon to and grab onto. I mean, we can try that, and it's not like, you know, but it's more that there's an activity that we, through our practice lives, we come to be committed to, and that inspires us and, you know, keeps us coming to sit on our cushions and to engage the precepts and to keep our practice fresh. And heart, because this term citta, actually the etymology of that term is close in Pali and Sanskrit to a word that means something like will or intention. And in fact, if you look in the, you know, if we don't spend a lot of time with sort of these categories of Abhidharma and so on and so forth, but, you know, the sort of Buddhist psychology that earlier schools and some Theravada schools engage in. But this idea of bodhicitta, that kind of thing, actually falls in under the heading of samskara. In other words, it's not an idea. It's more like a volitional... Samskara is the idea of conditioned mental factors, habit, impulse, you know, all these things that turn up in you know, we say no form, no feeling, no thought, no impulse, no, in the Heart Sutra. So it's actually, so I think this idea of citta, you know, awakening heart, is really more like, less like a mental construct and more like a inclination, a yearning, desire, if you will, that we, you know, in our practice lives, we get a sense that, yes, our lives are difficult, but in fact, there's a bigger picture that we can open up to. You know, and that's maybe one way of looking at it is the inception of bodhicitta. Now, historically, in the Mahayana tradition, well, let's stop back, step back a second. Bodhicitta is an inherently Mahayana concept. It has to do with the arising of the heart of a bodhisattva, a heart of being committed to not only one's own awakening, but awakening together with others. So it's very intimately associated with that idea. So actually, you know, if you look at the broad scheme of Buddhist history or whatever, you can talk about three kinds of bodhi. There's the bodhi of arhat, you know, the saint, the one who withdraws and purifies himself. There's the bodhi of the pratyeka Buddhas, you know, the guys, you know, those are sometimes called solitary Buddhas or non-teaching Buddhas. They can be people who, you know, who maybe have not heard the Dharma in the way that we hear it, but sort of wake up to the truths. But what these two things have in common in the Mahayana way of looking at it is that they're rather, so the pratyeka Buddhas, one of their characteristics is they don't teach. They enjoy their liberation, but they don't engage. And so, from the Mahayana point of view, that's what both the pratyeka Buddhas and the arhats have in common. That's why sometimes, in a rather, you know, way I wouldn't want to push too hard, are seen as kind of lesser paths. Whereas the bodhisattva path, you know, the idea is that at some point one decides to really go to the, you know, for, what is the word? Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. The complete, you know, you're going to aim for the full enlightenment of a Buddha, right? So in a way, it's much more ambitious. But when you look, and so in the Mahayana view, and a lot of Mahayana thinking, for example, things like Bodhicharya Vatara, this text by a guy named Shantidevi, an Indian guy, there's this thinking that it's like, you know, we want to generate, we engage in practice and we bring into the world, you know, we bring into our lives, you know, we produce this notion of bodhicitta. And it's this huge, huge advantage. It's like, you know, Jesus coming into the world, because at that point, you know, once you've generated that, the entire, it's sort of like, then it's just a matter of the bodhisattva path unfolding. And like in that particular text, you know, we talk about these things called the bhumis. There are tradition, most schemes, there are 10. And, you know, you go through these stages over lifetimes, and then you become a Buddha, you know, after long practice as a bodhisattva. So that's a sort of one way of looking at bodhicitta, the sort of positive thing, aspiring to Buddha's complete enlightenment, whatever that might be, and I'll get back to that in a second. But there's not sort of a negative way of looking at it, which is not, you know, which is like to not fall into the limited nirvana or practice of an arhat, or into the non-involvement of a pratyeka Buddha. So implicitness, you know, it's really important in this, is that, and this is why it's such a Mahayana, such a bodhisattvic concept, is that in our practice lives, we generate, we come to this idea of compassion. And in this kind of thinking, you know, when you read about bodhicitta, there's a distinction made in kinds of compassion. You know, one is that, you know, this wish that all beings be free of suffering. You know, so this applies, for example, to the path of the Arhat as well. But then there's this idea of great compassion, Dai Karuna, or Maha Karuna, excuse me, which is not only that you wish people to be free from suffering, but that you yourself want to become the agent working together with them towards the end of their suffering, towards the end of their you know, towards their liberation, as well as your own, without separation. This is very sort of a different kind of notion, because then we think about awakening heart as not just a matter of in sort of this intransitive sense of we are going to wake up, you know, we're going to work to wake up, but in a transitive sense, is like I'm going to be waking up and I'm going to be working to help the people in this room, to help the people in Chicago, to help the mountains on the West Coast, and to help all beings wake up. So it's a very different kind of thing. And I think, you know, for us as Zen practitioners who are not so much into this idea of, you know, I mean, we can talk about the boomies and so on and so forth, but that's not basically our language of thinking of lifetimes of going through successive stages of awakening. We're aiming to awaken now. And I think this sense of, you know, opening up to sort of a broader perspective of compassion, you know, and the way that relates to bodhicitta, even though we don't have this sense of like lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, I mean, that may be the situation, but we, in the Zen school, we tend to practice on, you know, sort of like this lifetime is enough for this lifetime. We've got plenty of work to do. But even in that context, I think that bodhicitta is a very important idea, hugely important idea. So in that sense, you know, even though a lot of the scriptures talk about bodhicitta as something that has to be generated or produced, that then becomes the generative cause of the unfolding of the bodhisattva path, you know, there's another way we can look at it, which I think is consistent with what I was talking about this not being an idea. And that's that we can think of it as a kind of an energy, maybe, a kind of something that runs through our practice, all the way through our practice, from beginning to end, and even though we might understand it differently, runs through it in its entirety and sustains it, provides the driving motive for us continuing in our practice, you know, day after day, you know, for many people, year after year. Yeah, so I'll let that stay where it is. People talk about ultimate bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta in these texts, and again, you know, this idea of ultimate bodhicitta, that is sometimes talked about as the mind that directly realizes emptiness or enlightenment, the enlightenment inherent in the mind, the awakening inherent in the mind. There's a text called the Maha Vairochana Bhimsa Bodhi Sutra that says, you know, defines this as knowing one's mind according to reality is bodhi, and bodhicitta is an innately pure mind that is originally existent. So from that definition, we can see that, you know, ultimate bodhicitta, what they're talking about is ultimate bodhicitta here, is very close to what we would say, you know, refer to in the Zen school as original mind, the sort of pre-existing thing that we already have, and we're just trying to wake up and come into awareness of how we have it. And I'll step back a little bit. This is one of the ways, even though there's a parallel, this is very different than sort of like the Christian view, where there's this fallen nature that's got to be redeemed, whereas the Buddhist view is more like there's this everlasting, you know, this shining, luminous mind that somehow become obscured. It's like they use images of clouds blocking the sun or whatever. And so that our job in practice is to try and, if not clear away those clouds entirely, to at least get more of a sense of that sun that's always been there, or that mirror. There are all kinds of images that are used, usually having to do with vision. So it's we become able more to see. Anyway, so ultimate bodhicitta is very close to that sun, that moon, that mirror. But then there's this other term, you know, relative bodhicitta, and that has to do with this sort of aspirational creation of an attitude, or, you know, these things I was talking about before, you know, which sort of turns up in like these other texts. I think this is what they're talking about when in those texts like the Shantideva's, where they're talking about the, you know, getting this bodhicitta and then setting out. You know, it's like bringing it. It's not that pre-existing original mind. It's this recognition. You know that, you know, the sense that, you know, there's some sun out there. There's some deeper picture beyond our suffering and our limitations, and then actually like, yeah, that's. So what do I do about that? You know, and for, you know, most of us in the Buddhist world, that's the idea of practice. So that's one aspect of this relative bodhicitta. The other aspect, at least according to Shantideva, is like not only sort of getting a sense of that picture, but then actually like, yeah, I'm actually going to set out, I'm going to work on this. You know, I'm going to practice. I'm going to explore this. Suzuki Roshi, you know, in Zenmai Beginner's Mind, he says at one point, it's wisdom that seeks wisdom. You know, so this, I think, refers to this ultimate bodhicitta. I mean, that's actually what is sort of ultimately behind this whole picture. But in another sense, it's us. It's the people, you know, it's people with names, people with identities. People who are sitting on cushions in this room who, you know, are motivated to engage in practice and you know, or come to a sense of this bigger picture. So in this sense, you know, when we look at our own lives, this relative bodhicitta is very, very intimately connected with the particularities of our own personal histories, our own ancient twisted karma, as it were. You know, I know that when I examine my life, it's very difficult for me to tell, you know, when I think about how I came to practice, you know, if there's any difference at all between my interest in, you know, sort of prodding this possibility of awakening, and, you know, the horrible tangled mess that my life was at the time I came to practice, and still is in many ways. And I don't know that there's a difference exactly. Maybe there is, maybe there's not. They're minimally very, very close. And so we've got two sides of this picture. We've got, you know, our ancient twisted karma, and we've got this, you know, wisdom that seeks wisdom. And, you know, they come together in our lives, and we are motivated to wake up. And not only wake up, you know, but within this idea of bodhicitta, it's this idea of waking up with others, waking up in the context of not only wisdom, but of compassion. It's the essential thing. And that's why this bodhicitta is such an inherently, I mean, it's completely, it's not separable from the idea of bodhisattva practice. It makes no sense in any other context. So, you know, it's like, you know, when I think about bodhicitta, it's maybe not so much like getting a idea and then trying to match our lives to the idea. It's like getting a whiff, you know, it's like you get a sense of something and you It's almost visceral. It's perceptual, and you know, and then you start to, you know, look around. Have you ever seen a dog like trying to identify the source of the smell? They're, you know, it's maybe a little bit like that. It's not abstract. It's very concrete. So, in closing, I'll just say a little bit about my own life. Taking it just another 2 or 3 minutes. As it turns out, it's almost exactly 40 years since I first had my introduction to Zazen. It was in the spring of 1974. It's got to be within a week or two of, you know, either way, of now, 40 years ago. And the context of that, there were lots of things going on in my life, lots of them not very good. And, you know, but as a college student at the age of 20, I had the opportunity to go do a weekend retreat. I don't remember if it was one night or two nights at Shasta Abbey. So 9 of us piled into a van, Olympia, Washington, blasted down to Shasta Abbey, you know, got this little taste of Soto Zen practice and blasted back up to Olympia, Washington. And, you know, there's something of that, you know, so like we, you know, they had to sit for maybe 2 or 3 periods. And, you know, I remember that because I remember all the, you know, a lot of stuff that happens when people first sit. I remember some of that kind of stuff. But, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, oh God, I'm seeing a face in this wall. Does that mean something? Of course it doesn't mean anything, you know, but it's like, I'm thinking, it's like, well, maybe this is, you know, I haven't done that before. Like, so, you know, but the part that really stayed with me is like, you know, I was assigned to go out and work with a monk. People had different tasks. Me and this very old-seeming monk, he might have been 40, went out and we were digging out a boulder. Hot day in California that day. And, you know, we worked in silence for a couple of hours. And there was, that's what I remember from this retreat. It was like, wow, there's something about the way this guy is doing this that is very, very interesting. And what's this about? You know, so it's like it's catching that, you know, saying talk, you see something, it's perceptual, you got a whiff, you get a sense of like, huh, and that you want to explore it more. And as it turns out in my life, you know, then that was the only interaction I had with Soto Zen for the next, you know, 25 years. My practice life started in earnest maybe 6 months later, but in a completely different context, in a Tibetan Buddhist context. And looking back at this idea, you know, this notion of bodhicitta, you know, I could see that, you know, reading these Tibetan texts, for example, I mean, I had this very, you know, idea of enlightenment, and it was this idea for me then, this kind of crazy idea where it's like, okay, what practice is about is, you know, the end, the goal of practice is to, you know, whatever, be able to shoot lightning bolts out of our head, or, you know, have, you know, or have these 33 qualities that, you know, Buddhas are described as having, and, you know, see rainbows or whatever, you know. And I mean, in a way that was motivating and it was sincere, but I think it was really, really misguided and immature. You know, and over the succeeding years, you know, there are a lot of schools, particularly in East Asia, you know, the Tendai and the Shingon and all these things, you get this idea of enlightenment in this very lifetime, in this body, you know, so it's like not this, you know, this sort of sense of like not something that's going to unfold out over kalpas, although it might in some sense, but, you know, in this lifetime. So I started thinking in those terms, but I still had this idea of, you know, that somehow my awakening might, in some sense, look like, you know, the way that Shakyamuni's awakening is described in the sutras or whatever. It's this very, you know, it was this idea, and it was a misuse of those texts, and it was a problem, and it was an impediment. You know, now my thinking, you know, after some years of of Zen practices, yeah, you know, what we're talking about is awakening in not this lifetime, but in this life. In other words, awakening within the context of, you know, being this guy named Eric Schutt who's got all kinds of, you know, crankiness and personality issues and, you know, whatever it is. I mean, waking up in this life, not having some cosmic something. I mean, people have these experiences and those, and great. But, you know, I would enjoy that. I would enjoy a trip to Paris, you know. But the real point is, you know, waking up in who we are, as we are, to the extent that we can. And doing that with Sangha, doing that with Dharma. And so in that sense, I think this idea of bodhicitta is, you know, when I try and play with this, it's not something I'd thought a whole lot about until Taigen suggested that I talk about it today. I think what bodhicitta is the this kind of not abstract thing, but this very kind of visceral, juicy quality that we can come to understand or tap into in our lives that sustains and energizes our practice from day to day, from year to year. It's not about some cosmic future event that somebody's going to write a sutra about. It's not that at all. It's about practicing here, practicing now, practicing with in our limited, hung up kind of way with other people who have issues of their own, but doing that together and sharing that. Anyway, so that's all I got. And if you've got any questions or comments, knock yourselves out. Douglas?
Thank you. That wasn't that's all you got. That was really very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the things that I think you talked about a little bit that I always thought about with bodhicitta is that, you know, it's easy if you think about it as developing an aspiration for something to happen in the future. But, you know, it is a turning and a recognition of what's going on in your life, what the problems are. I mean, having, in doing that, it's not just it's a recognition of, it's also a stepping out of, certainly. It's an awakening to the suffering, an awakening from the suffering. And so, and it comes with, then practice becomes an unfolding of that initial experience. So it's, you know, it's different from deciding you're going to go to the gym.
Yeah.
You know, because you want to look a certain way or become healthy or something. It is inherently, you are on the path. And you have waked up. And that unfolds more. I don't think you can necessarily peg it to a given experience, but the fact that someone's coming and sitting on a cushion is a suggestion that there's been something there. And I tend to think of it as then, you're right, it's hard to talk about bodhi-mind or aspiration. Sometimes I think of it as, in a way, it's the awakening of the Buddha spirit. Not in the sense of some sort of being spirit, but the energy and emotion and thinking at the same time all tied together. It's what our school spirit, the Bodhisattva spirit. Yeah. And it is that energy,
yeah,
that comes from having recognized what's going on in your own life and there's a turning. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you want to comment?
Yeah, where's the restroom?
Oh, that way.
That's two doors by back on the left.
It's weird. It's not mentioned. So, something you were talking about I appreciate you mentioning that there is an ultimate and a conventional bodhicitta. I really haven't contemplated that a lot.
Actually, I prefer the term relative bodhicitta to conventional, but
okay.
Yeah.
Relative and ultimate. Because I feel like there is this ultimate bodhicitta that exists, right? That doesn't require cultivation, that doesn't require me. Right? It's just there. But then there's this relative bodhicitta that I feel like has an... I can cultivate. And I think I've heard Tenshin talk about bodhicitta turning into giddiness as well. Like there's
giddiness.
This risk of flipping around and turning into giddy bodhisattva. And so... I was wondering, in your path, how you have what practice you use to cultivate bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta, without turning into giddiness.
It's an interesting question. You know, I mean, I think quite honestly. At no point have I set out to cultivate relative bodhicitta. It's more that, you know, as I've engaged in my practice, I've become aware that that was part of what was going on, that was what was growing and what was developing. You know, giddiness, that's such an interesting idea. I don't think I've been particularly giddy in my practice. I've got all kinds of other sort of... hindrances, but you know, giddiness. And, you know, I think my problem is sort of more the other side, mopiness.
You know, they're those seven dwarfs. You know,
yeah, right.
And mopey.
Those dwarfs are okay. You know.
Well, it isn't giddiness and mopiness just two sides of one coin.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah,
absolutely true.
Yeah,
good point.
And then there's giddy up and mopping up.
And slipping up and fucking up.
I can't top the seven dwarfs. But no, you're talking about the absolute and relative. And it's sort of in the Easter tradition as well. Sort of, you know, back when I was very much into evangelical Christianity, I remember doing a lot of study about the concept of faith. And, you know, there's not one particular definition, but there's a few different sort of aspects to it. But one of it was the sense that you take a future reality of sort of that time in the future when we're all going to be saved, and faith is what brings that present here. Huh. So it's kind of a time warp. And I think bodhicitta, in a really weird way, is like a bad sci-fi short story where the guy goes back in time and becomes his own grandfather, which, you know, the physicists all beat their heads against the wall because you can't really do it that way. But in a sense, bodhicitta is sort of like that. I don't think of it so much as a clear, absolute, and relative bodhicitta. I think of it as relative being maybe a reflection of that absolute, but they're not separate, in my mind. It's just simply bodhicitta.
Well, you know, you're right. They're not separate. I mean, this is like the harmony of difference and sameness. You know, this is another instance of that. I'm sorry to interrupt, but...
Right. No, and it's kind of reminding me of that, the Mountains and Waters Sutra that we've been reading. There's a section where Dogen says, you know, that it's after he starts blasting off on some other schools and stuff, and I don't remember the exact context, but he says... People have issues with this because they're not accustomed to things existing unsupported, is my recollection of it. Mm-hmm. And I think we think of bodhicitta, well, if we're going to have relative bodhicitta, it has to rely on this absolute bodhicitta. No. Bodhicitta is its own grandfather in that sense. It does not rely on something else. And the bodhicitta mind that we have in ourselves is not reliant on some sort of outside force. It is the actualization, it is the expression of bodhicitta, just simply being bodhicitta in my mind.
That's a great point.
Thank you. Just a couple little responses to that. On some level, how bodhicitta arises is kind of this great mystery. That what it is that at some point in our lives brings us to consider practice, to consider taking our lives seriously and turning towards, whether we do it with giddiness or mopiness, doesn't matter. We're taking our lives seriously and turning towards practice. Where that comes from, we don't know. It's kind of a mystery. And then how do we take care of that is, you know, a lifetime question. Or how do we take it on, each in our own circumstances, as Nyosan was saying. So that's one point. And then I like you bringing in the question of faith. And some schools, faith mind is kind of considered a kind of version of bodhicitta. That, and where that comes from also is a mystery. How is it that we suddenly, or sometimes gradually, I don't know, but that we give rise to a kind of trust in reality, to put it that way, trust in the Dharma, trust in our ability to act in a way that's compassionate, that's caring. So anyway, that's just riffing off what you were saying. Yeah. Other comments or responses? Joe?
Yeah, I really like the image of the whiff, getting a whiff. And when you think about what that is that you've already taken something in. It's already inside your nose, or you wouldn't have the whiff. You wouldn't have that experience. So you've already had that little bit of experience that tells you this is possible. And then you can have the intention of continuing to have that
I, you know, I don't think I mentioned it. Maybe I did, but related to that idea is: are people familiar with the 10 ox herding pictures? You know, one of the early pictures is, you know, getting a glimpse of the bull. You know, and it's very much like this, you know, this whiff notion, I think.
Linda.
You know, this all makes sense, but I was caught up at the beginning when you brought up resurrection and Easter. Oh. Certainly back in my Christian days, I've often thought about it, and I'm sort of trying to relate it to capture the sense of bodhicitta, which I don't think I'll ever capture. But I've often thought of resurrection, it's not a resurrection, never has been a resuscitation, it never goes sort of back to what was. Like, you know, when somebody's resuscitated, you're often resuscitated back into that state right before you fell in to, you know. And so, I don't know, I was sort of playing with some of that in my mind in terms of resurrection really has a very active element to it, and I also was sort of like going around that with the bodhicitta in terms of the awakening. You talk about this very active awakening heart. Or awakening part, not awakened, but awakened. Like, I don't have any deep thoughts here other than that. It was just more of the worlds that I often sometimes find myself sort of traveling into. I can't understand, like I was mentioning with Tigan some this morning, oops, I'm trying to approach, not out of this Christian context that I still feel like I come from at times, or how to be with it or sit with it or play with it. I think that probably says enough. I don't know what I just said, but I was struck with that at the beginning and sort of sat with that and listened to a lot of things. I also appreciated just the lightness that's come in the room.
I wanted to say, you know, I find myself doing this more and more. You know, I keep getting struck by these, like, oh, that's like Islam. This is, you know, and I'm not really very sort of interfaith in orientation. I don't have a strong religious background, so like bringing up Easter, if it's helpful, it's helpful. I hope it didn't introduce any confusion, but you know, it's a big day for lots more people in Chicago than us, and so I wanted to acknowledge that. And you know, and but I also think, you know, there was, I think, you know, and you guys who have a background in Christianity can tell me, you know, if my little parallel is totally off base, that's fine. But it was meant respectfully, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, I I didn't take it in any other than that. It's just sort of, I mean, I forgot. Don't let it, this part isn't recorded probably. I had actually, I spoke with my family yesterday. It was like, I'd forgotten that today was Easter. I sort of woke up that way too. I was like, you know, whereas that has been part of my life, you know, in a different way. So.
She's a former Christian seminarian, so that's a big deal that she forgot.
Deeply, deeply. Sorry, Mom.
But I appreciated what you said about the active quality of it. I think
something. Yeah,
and that came across. You know. Alex, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just kind of struck by your use of the word mystery. I have sometimes a hard time with trying to get my head around this wording, the word choice of bodhicitta, like what that means. And I guess the use of the word mystery struck me because to me it's like the experience. I was like, how could it be anything else? Like, it's just the most plain experience in the world in some ways. And so when I heard the word mystery, it's like, wow, it doesn't feel like a mystery, like an experience in some ways. And I guess I'm just kind of struck by like the idea, like I guess by the idea that there's mystery around it in the sense of like my personal experience of it feels like a maturing, like maturing my soul and just who I am as a person. So in that sense, it seems like a natural thing. But I look at my siblings or other people my age or where they're at in my life, and they've made these choices and they have this or this. So. There is something mysterious about it.
It's both simple and natural, and something about how it works is kind of mysterious. Yeah. Well, maybe it's about time to stop, unless somebody has a one last. Yes, Nicholas.
You know, for what I'm thinking is that it's a lot about participation and a willingness to participate in zazen, with the sangha, in chanting. In all of our different practices, but with the breath, with this moment, just a willingness to be awake right here, right now, and participate with whatever's going on.
Oh, again, I don't know that I have a particular response. I agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah, we participate in this together. We kind of perform Buddha's, Buddha's work together. So, yes, thank you.